members and members of the public. I'm going to start our committee. We don't yet have a quorum. We're not intending to take any votes today, but we have on our agenda primarily a presentation from Mr. George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services. What we're hoping to have the committee understand more fully is some of the details of the medical assistance component of the budget that we are going to be taking up. And so I've asked Mr. Hoffman, as the resident numerical expert at the department, to come and help us to understand what I believe to be fairly complex, but I'm sure with your help we'll be able to sort through it. So welcome to the committee, and if you could identify yourself for the record, and we appreciate your being here.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services.
And Mr. Hoffman, before you begin, I just want to, I know Senator Higgins isn't here yet, but when she comes, she'll certainly remind us that we need to have our microphones close to our, where we're speaking. So if you do that.
I'm the director of the division that forecasts caseloads and expenditures in our in the state's large entitlement programs. The largest of those is medical assistance, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. You should have some materials in your packet or included in your packet. One of the sheets starts basic terminology for DHS forecasted programs. And I thought it would be well to start with some of the basic terminology. Medicaid is the name of the federal means-tested medical program. Means-tested meaning that you have to have income and sometimes assets under certain limits in order to qualify for the program. It pays for both medical care and long-term care. Another federal program is Medicare. Medicare is not means-tested. You have to meet other requirements, such as quarters of work, and you have to qualify as being over age 65 or meeting disability requirements. The Medicare program pays for a fairly minor amount of long-term care because it only pays for rehabilitative care. You may have encountered this situation with elderly relatives. They have a hospital stay. They end up in a nursing home. Medicare pays for a while, but after the care turns into custodial care, Medicare doesn't pay anymore. And then you pay yourself, you use long-term care insurance, or you fall back on the medical assistance program. The medical assistance is Minnesota's name for its version of the Medicaid program. We also use federal Medicaid funding for a large part of the Minnesota Care program. For the pregnant women, children, and parents in the Minnesota Care program, we get a federal match from the Medicaid program. From the federal point of view, those individuals are on the Medicaid program, but they're not on what we call the medical assistance program. Medicaid eligibility, since the start, has been categorical in nature, and this categorical nature of eligibility goes back to to the public aid programs that were in existence at the start of the Medicaid program. In order to be eligible for Medicaid or in Minnesota medical assistance, you have to be age 65 or older. You have to be disabled or blind according to the disability definition of the Federal Supplemental Security Income Program, or under age 21, which is Minnesota's definition of a child in its medical assistance, program, a parent or caretaker of a child under 21, or a pregnant woman. Now, the category which is left out, and part of the reason I'm explaining this is so that you can understand the nature of the Medicaid expansion for adults without children. Non-elderly, non-disabled adults who are not the custodial caretaker of a child are the group who were not included in the categories of eligibility for the Medicaid program. And the Medicaid expansion or the medical assistance expansion adds that category to coverage in the program. This is the group which historically was covered in Minnesota by the General Assistance Medical Care Program. And we adopted that program back in the 70s as a supplement to the coverage of the medical assistance program.
Mr. Hoffman, can I interrupt you for 1 minute before you progress here, just to clarify? You're describing Medicaid as means-tested. And then you've also mentioned that there are these categories and that the recent expansion expanded the categories to which medical assistance or Medicaid would apply to. But weren't there also changes in the means testing as part of the expansion as well?
There were the expansion of Medicaid coverage and of medical assistance coverage has two parts. We work the Medicaid program is an extremely complicated legal construct, and my department spend a lot of time dealing with the legal issues of it. Medicaid is in origin optional for the states. The states didn't have to adopt Medicaid programs. Almost all of them did. Arizona didn't for a while. Almost all of them did, but if you do, then you have to follow all the rules and limitations which are set by the federal government. And the historical categories of who could be eligible are part of that. Over the years, the federal government also set certain minimum coverages where if you had a Medicaid program, you had to cover children ages 1 to 18 up to at least a certain poverty level, 133% of the poverty level. And you had to cover pregnant women up to at least 185% of the poverty level. Now, the Medicaid expansion has the same sort of rules attached to it. What is in the federal law now is a mandatory expansion to cover adults without children up to 133% of the poverty level. The effective date of the mandatory coverage is January of 2014. And part of the rules that are either in federal law or regulation is that you can't apply an asset test to this group. And so those are part of the criteria that the federal government has attached to this mandatory coverage.
Could I, Mr. Hoffman, interrupt you again? You haven't mentioned as part of the requirements under Medicaid any, and I would imagine these are the state components, but are there residency requirements under the current Medicaid structure, and are those changed under the expansion laws that were adopted?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any change in residency requirements. I'm not expert in the technical in the legal aspects of this. I think
I don't even know if it's
the residency requirement is in effect that you have to be here and intend to remain. As far as I know, the same applies to the Medicaid expansion for adults without children. So that's the context of the Medicaid expansion. I said we have a mandatory expansion under federal law starting in January of 2014. The states have an option to take up that coverage earlier if they want at an income level at or less than the 133% of poverty level. The state, based on 2010 legislation and an executive order from the governor, is putting an early expansion, is the term we've been using for it, is putting an early expansion in place starting effective March 1st of this year, up to 75% of the poverty level, which is the same as the income level for the historic GAMC program. Now the federal funding for the medical assistance program for services, medical services, is available as a matching rate. The federal government in Minnesota, the normal matching rate is 50%. So as a rule, on the medical services that we pay for in the medical assistance program, we spend, for each dollar, we spend 50 cents of state money and 50 cents of federal money. Now, the 50% rate, each of the states has its own rate. The rates are defined in federal statute, or the methodology for the rates is defined in federal statute. It's based on the personal per capita income of the state compared to personal per capita income of the nation. And the result is, in this calculation, that the states that have a relatively lower personal per capita income get a higher federal matching rate. And so historically, Mississippi has gotten the highest matching rate, and it runs in the neighborhood of 70% federal money. So in Mississippi, they pay 30 cents, and the federal government pays the 70 cents. A Minnesota's normal rate is at the floor of 50%. 50% under this federal law, 50% is the lowest matching rate that applies to all the states. If we apply,
Mr. Hoffman, can I interrupt 1 second? Senator Higgins, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, if we don't spend the 50 cents of the dollar for state money, do we lose the 50% or the other 50 cents in federal money?
Mr. Hoffman.
We can only use the federal money by spending it.
So if we,
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, so if we don't spend it, then we don't have the federal money to go along with it.
Mr. Hoffman.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Hoffman, the other thing.
Senator Higgins.
And I'm just going to sound like a broken record, Mr. Chair.
It's all right, Senator
I don't know
Higgins.
If I'm in a dead zone or what, but I can't hear you. So
I tried to warn you, Mr. Hoffman, beforehand that there is a dead zone over there and maybe over there, too.
Just bring your microphone way up close to you. The first thing everybody does when they sit down is they move the microphone away. And then I just...
Okay.
Yeah. So just bring it right up close.
I don't need to see if it's turned on. It is
on. You just have to keep talking until you can hear yourself up there.
Thank you, Senator Higgins.
The
Mr. Hoffman,
government, as a matter of managing cash flow, only releases the money as we spend it. They don't hand us any money that we get to put in the bank. They only allow the money to go out as we spend it. They watch the timing with which warrants are cashed. We have to give them an estimate every... We actually give them a forecast of what we're going to spend for the next couple of years. And the most important part of that estimate is what we're going to draw in the next quarter. And so they watch very carefully. We get a letter of credit that allows us to draw down the federal money. But yes, we only get to use the federal money as a match for our own money being spent.
Thank you.
Now, I said the normal matching rate is 50%. As part of the economic stimulus legislation, the federal government temporarily increased the matching rates for all the states. And so for most of the last year, and starting October 1st of 2008, we got an enhanced matching rate. It's changed a bit over time. For the last calendar year, we got a federal share of 61.59% instead of 50%. So that means that it cut a big piece off of what the state would otherwise have spent out of its own funds. We are currently, we have an enhanced matching rate in the current quarter, but what's happening is a phase down of the enhanced federal matching. So we are currently getting a federal matching rate of about 58%. And then in the next calendar quarter, it's going to go down to 55%. And then starting July 1st, it's going to be back to the regular rate of 50%. The existence of this enhanced federal matching is the principal reason why the biennial increase in state expenditures in medical assistance looks so large, because in the 10-11 biennium, we will have gotten approximately $1.5 billion worth of enhanced federal matching, which held down state expenditures by a like amount, And so that's a large piece of the state expenditure increase, which occurs between the 10-11 biennium and the 12-13 biennium. I would
Excuse
propose
me,
to
Senator
go
Hill.
On to some.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hoffman, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Thank you, Senator Hand. I just want to make sure I'm very clear about what you just said, that the enhancements that you're describing now, we were able to lower what we expended from our resources because of that enhancement. And as part of our budget balancing, we were able to, as a result of that, retain a certain service level. We didn't have to cut service levels, even though we did reduce the amount of spending from our end of that relationship. But with the reduction in those enhancements, we're confronted with either restoring our balance of funds or making cuts, correct? Is that correct?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, that's essentially the position we're in. Yes.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to be sure I understood that, because there's been some discussion about the recent proposed cuts being cuts that we've agreed to in the past, but in fact we did not agree to cuts. We were able to maintain service levels because of enhancements.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, we also made some cuts. We also made some cuts in the 2009 and in the 2010 sessions. Obviously, it was the intention of the federal government to help deter the states from making large cuts in their programs. And the federal government also attached strings to the funding in the form of maintenance effort requirements. The principal one of which is that we could not cut eligibility for our programs until the expiration of the enhanced funding. What has happened in the meanwhile is that the federal legislation, the ACA legislation, extended equivalent maintenance of effort requirements for a longer time. So what was attached to temporary federal funding as a temporary maintenance of effort now has become a longer standing maintenance of effort.
Senator
Sharon.
And I think that, Mr. Albrecht, you referred to this in your presentation as well, correct, that anything that looks like, maybe it wasn't here, I've heard your presentation a couple, anything that comes close to looking like a change in eligibility would be considered problematic in our legislation. Did I hear you report that?
Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, that's correct.
Thank you very much. And then one
Senator
follow-up.
Sharon.
So, yes, I understand that our cuts were deeper than what the enhancements were, but clearly the enhancements were we understood that we were not making cuts. We're not agreeing to cuts or making cuts because we were able to soften that blow by those enhancements to the state's programs.
I think that's right, yes.
Mr. Albrecht, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, the question that you're asking Mr. Hoffman, I believe, is related to the reductions that are in Senate File 60. And those are outside the Medicaid program and outside the direct effect of the increased federal matching funds. So the federal money that mitigated the impact of those reductions is money that went directly to the counties as a result of the enhanced FMAP, but not through the enhanced FMAP that came to the state.
Thank you.
I'll go over that with him later, if that's okay with you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. And members, this is a complex, as Mr. Hoffman pointed out, these interrelationships are complicated, and I do want to have an opportunity for us to do the best we can to understand that, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted Mr. Hoffman to come today. And let me restate for my understanding what you were telling us, which is, and I'm going to use an analogy from a part of the budget I understand a little bit better, which is the education budget. We have put in place a shift where we have, as a state, delayed payments to the school districts and, in effect, have borrowed or retained money to allow us to balance the state budget, at least as it pertains to the education portion. In a way, we're the federal increase in the percentage of the, or the change in the match amount is, in effect, trying to do the same thing, is that we are allowing ourselves by the change in the federal matching requirements allowed us to maintain a level of programming even though we weren't fulfilling our entire match. And as I understand what your point is, that because of the change in the percentage of federal match going from, it's at 58%, you said currently, then going to 55 and then back to 50 by July, we are in effect buying back that shift, if you will, from the federal government, and it will affect the next budget period that we are working on. And it's, to your point, one of the reasons why there's such a large percentage of increase in this area of the budget, because we are now picking up that portion of these programs that was being covered at least temporarily through federal funds. And I think the other part of this I want to understand is that you mentioned the maintenance of effort requirements were put in place sort of as a condition of our agreeing not to change these federal programs as we were going through this enhanced funding, matching funding from the federal government. But the recent change in the law has extended those maintenance of effort requirements, and I'm not clear from your answer, is that a permanent extension or is that temporary, or just how long do those maintenance of effort requirements bear on the state and our ability to make decisions about how funds are used?
Mr. Chairman, they're in general extended until 2014, when major parts of the implementation of the new law are scheduled. But for children, they extend to 2019. Now, I'm not sure I can tell you exactly why it's different for children, but I know that that's the terms of the maintenance of effort.
Right.
So we can't change eligibility or procedures connected to eligibility. For example, if we've been redetermining eligibility at a certain interval, we can't shorten that interval. We can change rates, and we can change the coverage of services, but we can't change eligibility for individuals under the maintenance of effort.
Thank you.
If I would go on from there to some discussion of the spending trends in the program as a whole, or in the parts of the medical assistance program, you should have a sheet which is labeled Medical Assistance Program Growth by segment. We split expenditures in the medical assistance program into four large pieces. They used to be separate budget activities. They're not anymore, but they still serve a useful descriptive purpose. This is a So the first of those has an A on top of it on this sheet. It's long-term care facilities. Most of the spending here is on nursing home care for what is currently about 17,000 people. ICFMR care is also included in this category. ICFMR is a group home for the developmentally disabled. If you look at the trend in this part of medical assistance, it's been declining. And it's been declining because the number of people in nursing homes and the number of people in ICFMRs has been going down over the years. If you want to know where they're going to the next box, which is B, which is LTC waivers, long-term care waivers. They are known as waivers because they are special arrangements with the federal government under which, as an alternative to care in an institution, we offer alternative services which help to keep the person out of the institution. We have five of these home and community-based waivers, and they are variously alternative to nursing home care, alternative to ICFMR care, or alternative to inpatient hospital care. Here you see the trend has been rising. Expenditures have been rising, including the forecasted period. We have an average expenditure trend of 8.8% a year. On the facility part, we have a negative expenditure trend of 1.75% a year. If you add these two together, which is a reasonable thing to do, because that is representative of what we've been spending on long-term care services, then we have an average expenditure trend over the years of 4.9%. Most of that trend comes from more people being served. But it also comes from increases in the cost of care. So it's a mix of those two things. The dollars included so far are just the costs of the long-term care services. They don't include the costs of general medical care for the people in long-term care. It's only the long-term care services. If we go on to the next block, elderly and disabled basic care, that's where we pay for the basic medical care of the people in long-term care and the elderly and disabled people who are not in long-term care. Now, we have about 60,000 elderly enrollees on the medical assistance program. About two-thirds of them are either in a nursing home or they're in our alternative to nursing home care, which is called elderly waiver. For the elderly, it tends to be the need for long-term care services that puts them on the program. Our cost for the basic care of elderly people on the medical assistance program is is his relatively modest because almost all of them are on Medicare. And so Medicare pays the big hospital and doctor bills for this population. And the medical assistance program, as far as general and pharmacy, and the medical assistance program acts like a Medicare supplement for their for the things Medicare does not pay for. If we look at the disabled, at the other part of this population, they're currently about 110,000 enrollees, and about half of them have Medicare, and something less than half of them are in long-term care arrangements. So now, not all of the disabled are in Medicare because more than disability is required to be eligible for Medicare. You have to have quarters of work coverage and earnings coverage, and half of the medical assistance disabled population doesn't meet the requirements to get Medicare coverage. So for half, we pay for all their basic medical care, and for half, we supplement Medicare. The fourth block.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Hoffman, before you go to the next box, would you talk a little bit about the 2012 projected number that looks so out of line with everything else?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, that's the result of a budget shift. That's the result of a budget shift. We are going to, by law, we are going to delay about $100 million in payments in June of 11 and not pay them until the next month. And this was a measure put in law in the, I think, 09 session and modified in the 2010 session. And so it distorts the trend because it makes 11 lower, and then it makes 12 much higher, and so it looks like a huge increase in 12. But it's as far as the state's actually incurring obligations, you would want to smooth those numbers out, and that's why the average trend is a fairly good measure of how these things have been doing, or the you can, well, it's been higher some years, lower other years, but it's in the neighborhood of 7% a year in the growth in the state's actual obligations in the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. And Mr. Hoffman, I thank you, Senator, for your question. I had the same question. And just to clarify, we delayed payments. Is that essentially what and this is a reflection of the, at least for the forecast, the assumption that we're going to catch up those payments and go back on a current basis of paying. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, it was 09 legislation, or I think it originated in 09, that says that for certain categories of payment, what we would normally pay in June 2011, we will pay at the beginning of July 2011. And so the forecast is simply representing what the law says we have to do with the payments. Obviously, June 11 is the end of a biennium, and the purpose of that change was to shift some costs into the 12-13 biennium and out of the 10-11 biennium.
And Mr. Hoffman, just as I'm hearing you describe that, it sounds like there was a month of obligations that we didn't pay and shifted to the following fiscal year.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if, I mean, that's a fairly significant increase. Was that month a big month in payments or costs? Or would that seems like an awfully large increase attributed to a one-month shift in cost. Or am I missing something here?
Mr. Chairman, it's actually a fairly low month. But it is the expected value for a June, given the way our overall expenditures are going. It's actually a fairly normal amount. I don't have the list of services on tap. It includes inpatient hospital, outpatient hospital, physician, a lot of other medical providers, excludes pharmacy. Families with children, and you'll see the same thing in this piece too, although it's not as strong on the families and children because there is not as much fee-for-service business there. So fee-for-service is not as large a piece, therefore the delay of fee-for-service payments at the end of fiscal year 2011 doesn't have as much impact.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Hoffman, how much of the elderly and disabled basic care is fee-for-service as opposed to managed care?
Mr. Hoffman?
In kind of round terms.
The elderly enrollee population is about 80% in managed care. The disabled enrollee population is only about 5% in managed care. So that's 80% of 60,000 for the elderly, 5% of 110,000. So it's about a third of the people, but it's more than a. It's less than a third of the expenditures are in managed care. I would have to look at the figures, but at least two-thirds of what we spend on basic care for the elderly and disabled are fee-for-service, where it's more like 20% for the children, parents, pregnant women. And it's mostly because the disabled group is more expensive, and they're largely in a fee for service status.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman.
Children and parents. We've had an average expenditure trend of 10.8%. We had big increases in enrollment because of the recession, and enrollment is still high relative to what we had been expecting before the recession. We've currently got about 470,000 people enrolled in this group. At the start of the recession, we raised our forecast about 15% and had to raise it small amounts after that. So in a sense, the recession has accounted for about a 20% increase in this enrollee population. And the trend here is mixed. It's about 50-50, more enrollment and higher cost of coverage.
And Mr. Hoffman, to that point, and I wanted to call attention to that to the committee. And all these things that you've been describing, all the boxes that we've just reviewed, in your notes underneath where you talk about explanation for growth, the first two, the long-term care, the explanation is that it's the increases are driven about equally, you say, between the cost of care and increases in number. For the elderly disabled basic care, you say that 40% of the growth is enrollment increase and 60% to increase in cost. And then family and kids, half, again, 50%, 50%. The question I want to get at, and maybe and you may not be the right person, we may have to go somewhere else, but if you have anything you can share with us, the thing I'm wrestling with is that if you're paying a certain amount of money for whatever the program might be in family and children basic care, and you have a increase in enrollment, you'd expect that number to grow. But it also seems as if you're saying that not only is the enrollment growing, but whatever it is, that thing that we're doing, has gotten more costly. And I'm interested to know what is the things that are being done differently this year compared to last year that have driven up, the, in effect, the per-unit cost of care to go up to account for 50% of the growth in the total dollars. Is there anything you can, and it seems to be consistent in all these programs.
You know, the simple answer is that the cost of medical care goes up over time, and so part of what we bear in running a medical program is increases in the cost of coverage. In the long-term care services, historically, the legislature, often in the governor's budget, the administration has proposed COLA increases in to recognize long-term care service costs increasing on the part of providers. In that area, in the 2009 session, we did an UNCOLA of 2.58%, and that was in effect a cut in the rates. Much of the growth in what we spend, especially on the children, parents, pregnant women, since 80% of them are in managed care arrangements, much of the increase that we see comes from annual adjustments in the capitation rates. And the annual adjustments in the capitation rates are based on our actuaries' observations of what is happening to health plan costs to serve the population we have in managed care. And we've had those rates go up, but we're also currently having those rates come down a bit. Now, we're having a decrease in rates effective this month of about 2%, which is recognizing that the utilization of the population of children and parents in our program did not go up as much as expected in the past year. We're seeing the same thing in our fee-for-service experience for the same group. Part of what's going on, we had a 15 to 20% increase in enrollment because of the recession. It's fairly likely that brought a healthier population into the program and had an effect on the utilization. Something else that we know is happening is that the enrollee population is having fewer babies, as is the general population with the bad economy. And we paid the highest capitation rates for the pregnant women and the infants under 1 year So if we have relatively fewer pregnant women and infants born, the average unit cost, if you will, the cost of a month of coverage under the program comes down a little bit. So that's a part of what we have been seeing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for that. And I just want to suggest, and perhaps to you but to the committee, that as we go forward and look at the budget, that I think we need to understand that. To me, it seems not unreasonable to say if we have growth in a program, we should perhaps expect that growth to occur at the same rate of cost as it did the previous year. And if we just applied that roughly to the things you've got on this table, there would be significant savings. Now, I'm not trying to solve the budget here today or make that to suggest that's how we would do it. But I think it is important that we understand what the 50% of the growth is that is attributed to cost increase, that we have a better understanding of what that is, since most of the experience that we have and what we hear from our constituents is that things are pretty flat in the economy. And to say that in this particular section we're going to see a significant growth rate in the unit cost, I think we need to understand that better. And again, I'm not asking you to answer that. You may not be the right person to have the detail, but I think that as we proceed, we will need to know more about that.
Those are the, when you put all of that together, the average expenditure trend growth in the medical assistance program for the last 10 years has been running about 8% a year. So expenditures have been going up on average about 8% a year. When you turn that into a biennial increase, you get approximately 2 times 8%, because a biennial increase is representative of 2 years of growth. When you look at 12-13 over 10-11, you could think of the midpoint of the biennium over the midpoint of the previous biennium. That's a 2-year time frame. I thought I would take some time, Mr. Chairman, to explain a little bit about how our forecast plays into the budget process. The state does an expenditure and revenue forecast twice a year, in November and in February. Our forecast of enrollment and expenditures in the programs is a contribution to the state expenditure forecast. So we update our forecast on the same schedule. The MMB oversees our forecast fairly lightly, I would say. They generally accept our forecast. Sometimes they have some questions about it, and we go over some things. Our forecast for the programs becomes the base for the budget. And so the governor, we're engaged now in helping the governor make a budget. The governor's budget is going to be based on the November forecast plus a set of changes which the governor is going to propose. And subsequently, when we get to the February forecast, we'll shift to a slightly different base, and then we'll update the change numbers in the governor's budget. The same sort of thing happens in the case of fiscal notes. If we do fiscal notes now, We work off of the base of our forecast. If we're looking at a rate change in some medical assistance service, we calculate it off our forecasted expenditures over the years, because we do our forecast year by year. And so we have trend built into that forecast. And then if you say we want to increase or decrease a certain rate, we can say, okay, we take that percentage times our forecasted expenditures for that service. And so that, where it's workable, that's how we do a fiscal note when you look at changes in a, when you propose changes in the program. And if we did a fiscal note today, we would work off the November forecast. If we do a fiscal note after the end of February, we're going to work off of the February forecast, and we're going to update the old fiscal notes to be based on the February forecast instead of the November forecast. Now, for most things, there are only going to be very minor changes between the November forecast and the February forecast. So updating it to the February forecast in most cases is a technical issue rather than an issue of substance. That's what I wanted to say about forecast and budget. Does the chair want to ask some further questions or appoint me where he would like me to go?
Well, I want to just check with the members of any questions on the forecast process, and I think we do recognize that there will be that whatever we see next from the governor will be based on the November numbers, and understand the modification that will occur as a result of the February numbers. So I'm not sure that I have any questions on that if other members don't. You have in your packet some additional material. Is that something that you wanted to cover with respect to cash assistance? Are these also portions that are funded partially by federal dollars?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Moving to the next page, MFIP, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, this is another state and federal program where we have a state name and a federal name. The federal name is TANF, Transitional Assistance to Needy Families. It's the successor of the old AFDC program. The program was turned in, from the federal side, the program was turned into a block grant to the state. And so we have a sum of federal money available. I believe it's about $260 million, which we can tap for the funding of the MFIP program and certain other qualifying expenditures. There is also a complicated maintenance of effort issue here too, where the state needs to continue spending as much as it did in a base period, which is quite a way back. I can't tell you what the year is offhand, but we have to continue spending either in the MFIP program or other qualified expenditures. And the two largest area of those expenditures that can qualify are the child care assistance program and tax credit. I'm not coming up with the right name. Tax credit for but for working people. So, I'm not expert on the maintenance of effort in this area, but the funding is messy because it's not a simple matching rate like the medical assistance program. It's if we spend up to certain levels in qualifying areas, we can tap the full available amount of federal funding. And so we get, in our forecast, we get a certain amount of fluctuation in what we can count as maintenance of effort, how much state money has to be used, how much federal money has to be used. There are further complications in that parts of the MFIP program are funded with only state money. And I think I would leave it at that if the chair lets me get away with that.
Mr. Hoffman, thank you. I wanted to ask counsel or Mr. Albrecht if you know the reference to the maintenance of effort rule and what is the constraint? Do you know? I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't have the answer to that, but is there a time that we cannot reduce, or a level that we cannot reduce beyond? Is that, in effect, what we're saying?
Mr. Chair, excuse me. It's more that...
Mr. Hoffman.
We have to spend up to our quota in qualifying expenditures to draw the full amount of federal funding. So it's not that we, and then that applies every year. So I should let Joan.
Ms. White, do you have a comment or helpful that I hope to sort through this?
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the questions that you had was that we need to maintain the 1994 level.
1994.
Of what was spent on the program at that point. And the other is the earned income tax credit is the tax that we use for the maintenance of effort.
And Mr. Hoffman and Ms. White, just so that I understand this, we had a level of spending in 1994 in these programs, and what the federal rules say is that we cannot, reduce our total spending below that level? Is that what the requirement says, or... Mr. Hoffman?
We have to spend state money on certain qualifying types of expenditures up to that amount in order to qualify to use the full amount of federal money. Now, if I remember right, the full amount of federal money is about $260 million, and the full amount of state spending is $180-some million.
And Mr. Hoffman, do you know offhand, I assume that we are at or above that 1994 level. Do you know if we are above, how much above that level we are?
Our assistance program is actually considerably smaller, and that's why we're not able to reach the required level of spending on the MFIP program, and that's why we count state expenditures on the child care program as a part of the maintenance of effort, and that's also why we count some of the earned income tax credit expenditures as part of the maintenance of effort. So what we spend in part of what we spend as tax expenditures on the earned income tax credit is able to be counted as part of the maintenance of effort for this.
And so, Mr. Hoffman, are you saying then that we are just meeting that level of 1994 expenditures, or are we above that level?
I think we typically only count expenditures till we hit what we need to, which allows us to draw the full amount of federal funding.
I see. Thank you. Other questions on this? I know it's pretty clear to everybody, so I hesitate to ask if there are any questions here. But Mr. Hoffman, did you have other things that you wanted to present to us at this point?
I could go on briefly on the other three programs that are on this sheet.
Mr. Hoff, why don't you do that, and we'll see if we have if it gets clearer.
It will be simpler than
thank you
than MFIT. The general assistance program is totally state money. It's operated at the state's option, and there aren't any federal entanglements here. We do get some revenue back when we, which is not accounted for, at least currently, in the general assistance forecast, because when we pay general assistance for somebody who is an applicant for supplemental security income, and they months later get a favorable disability determination, they have signed an interim assistance agreement with us, and so when SSI pays them a grant back several months, we get the general assistance payments back. So there is a federal interaction there, but there isn't any federal requirement about this program. It's a different situation with the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program. This is a program that offers a supplemental grant to SSI recipients, supplemental security income recipients, for a person who lives in the community. It's a supplement typically of $81 per month. We are, since the start of the SSI program in 1972, we are under an obligation to maintain effort in this program, and the way the state has opted to maintain effort in this program is to maintain payment standards. It was part of the rule. It was part of federal law when they started the SSI program back in the 70s. The states at that time had their own categorical aid programs for the elderly, blind, and disabled. Some states, like Minnesota, had higher assistance standards than the new SSI program was going to have. And the federal government didn't want the start of the new program to result in a decrease in assistance to the people on the new program. And so it put into law a maintenance of effort requirement, which in effect means that even though SSI payments go up more or less annually, we have to continue, to put it in the simplest terms, we have to continue paying an $81 supplement. We can't say your SSI went up $15, and so we're going to pay you $15 less. And that's the terms of the maintenance of effort that affects that. The group residential housing program used to be a part of the MSA program. One piece used to be a part of the MSA program. One piece used to be a part of the general assistance program. And it paid for the housing of individuals whom the county had placed in a placement because of their need for most of the people in this program are SSI recipients, and they're either elderly or disabled. A smaller number are are people who would qualify for the general assistance program and whom the counties have placed. The county placement applies to all of the people in this program. The county has to make a decision that a person needs the kind of supportive living arrangement that the various facilities paid by this program offer. And so the part affecting the elderly and the disabled has some maintenance of effort issues going back to the start of the SSI program.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman, and members. If any questions at this point, I appreciate your patience. I know this is complex, as we and Mr. Hoffman mentioned initially. But I think it's important that we try to understand this as we wrestle with the budget. I think these constraints and these issues that are being raised today are going to come into play, and I think in some cases they will. Perhaps preclude us taking certain directions or pursuing certain solutions and being compelled to look in other places. And we need to understand that as we begin to look at the budget. So I guess if there are no questions, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that we've gone long a couple of our previous meetings, and it's about 10 minutes to noon. I failed to note earlier on that we did achieve a quorum sometime about half an hour into the meeting, so I want to make sure I get that on record. But with that, members, we're adjourned.